this session is going to be something of a potpourri because today we're going to take a brief look at all of the types of psalms we haven't discussed so far. And since we've only discussed three types, we have a few to look at here. But they all relate together under the category that we saw on that schema in the first session, the great pattern of distress, deliverance, and the community's response. Almost all of these psalms give us some perspective or insight into the community's life. The community that responds both in memory and in vision to the deliverance that has already been given in the midst of their distress. So we'll see the community response mainly in two different ways. We'll see it in terms of the worship life. We've already been looking, of course, at the worship life of Israel, but now we'll see some of those special occasions in the worship life of Israel when she particularly was concerned for keeping that memory alive, such as the great festival occasion. We'll also see some psalms that give us insight into the community's response as a different kind of community in the living out of day-to-day life. There will be some psalms that give us some perspective on how a community that understood itself to be a delivered community acts and lives differently because they know themselves to be brought into being as a result of God's grace. So we'll look first of all, I think, at some of the great festival psalms. There are psalms, as we've been looking at them, that deal with the ongoing occasions of worship. But included in the Psalter are those psalms that seem to relate to the great festival occasions. There were three great festivals in ancient Israel. There came to be more in later Judaism, but the three in ancient Israelite worship were the pilgrimage festivals of Passover, the festival of weeks, which later came to be known as Pentecost, and the Feast of Tabernacles. Two of these were in the spring, Passover and weeks, and the third was in the fall. All of them were related to the agricultural year and to the ripening of different chief crops or products of the land. So they all involved the bringing of agricultural products in thanksgiving to the temple. The autumn feast eventually became the most important. That sometimes surprises people. I think we tend to think of Passover as the most important. But in ancient Israel, it was really the Feast of Tabernacles in the fall that was the most important, because it was at the Feast of Tabernacles that the covenant was renewed. And so there would often be, in that time, a remembrance of all of the great historic moments that are a part of the covenant tradition, and perhaps even a reenactment of them. Often as a part of the festival life, there was in a combination of drama, dance, and music, the great events of Israel's history would be reenacted, depicted once again, as well as recited and sung about. The Passover festival was also important, and in the later years of Judaism, particularly in the period after the Babylonian exile, Passover became more and more important in the remembrance of Exodus, which it focused on. But the difference was that Passover achieved its greatest importance when it eventually became a home festival. If you've had any contact with Judaism yourself, you know that Passover now is chiefly a festival that's observed in the home by individual families. And it was when it became a home festival after the destruction of the temple, really even after the destruction of the second temple in 70 AD, that it became such an unusually prominent festival in the Jewish calendar. It was always important as one of the three great festivals, but it was not the central festival for ancient Israel. Now, one of the things that we must remember is that due to the accidents of history, the traditions that we have remaining to us in the Psalms come largely from the south. It was the southern kingdom of Judah which survived to hand on these traditions for us. So most of these materials come via the Jerusalem temple and its developed worship life. For that reason, many of the festival psalms reflect that kind of southern theology. By a southern theology, I mean that the kingship of David and the theology of God's dwelling on Mount Zion, which is the Temple Mount, figures prominently in these festival observances, because God's giving of the Davidic kingship and God's dwelling on Mount Zion were considered to be acts of God's grace alongside of Exodus and the other great traditions of the Mosaic period. So we'll be wanting to look today too at some royal songs and some enthronement songs. Now, let's look for instance at a psalm which comes from one of the festival observances. Let's look at 132. This is a very Davidic psalm. One that probably was used at the time of the fall festival, the Feast of Tabernacles. Tabernacles, by the way, refers to, or sometimes you hear this called booths, the Feast of Booths. That refers to the building of the temporary structures in the wilderness. And so the wilderness tradition is also remembered at this time, since the stay at Sinai was a part of that wilderness tradition. For that reason, it became appropriate to renew the covenant at the fall festival. But the name itself, Feast of Booths or Feast of Tabernacles, refers to the temporary dwellings of the wilderness. For that reason, even in contemporary Judaism, in the observance of this festival, Orthodox Jewish families will build a booth in the back of their house or something where certain observances are held. If any of you who have lived near synagogues, you may have seen this practice, which continues. This is a Davidic psalm. Or by this I mean it reflects the theology of David. And it tells a kind of a story of David's search for the ark. When David became king, the ark had been lost to the Philistines for over 50 years. And one of his first acts as king was to find the ark, which was the symbol of the old covenant league and the symbol of God's presence in the midst of Israel, and to bring it to Jerusalem. And in that way, to indicate the king's responsibility to the religious life of the community. So this begins by retelling that story. Remember, O Lord, in David's favor, all the hardships he endured, how he swore to the Lord and vowed to the mighty one of Jacob, I will not enter my house or get into my bed. I will not give sleep to my eyes or slumber to my eyelids until I find a place for the Lord, a dwelling place for the mighty one of Jacob. Lo, we heard of it in Ephrathah. Now, if we didn't look up some of these words, like Ephrathah, we found it in the fields of Ye'ar, and find out about Ye'ar, we might not know what it was that they heard of. It would have been obvious, of course, to the Israelite worshiper. The it that was heard of was the Ark of the Covenant. And these refer to some of the places associated with its long exile. And it was found, and then then verse 7 says, let us go to his dwelling place, let us worship at his footstool. The ark was known as the footstool of God because the ark was a kind of a box with winged creatures on the top, above which God was said to be invisibly enthroned. So the ark would, in effect, be God's footstool as he sat invisibly enthroned above it. So if we wanted to find the story and read the entire story of this in a narrative fashion, that's found in 2 Samuel 7, the whole story of David's search for the ark and bringing it to Jerusalem. You may remember that David, in bringing it to Jerusalem, danced before the ark himself with a great display of joy and celebration. And in dancing before the ark, he took off his outer robe and danced in his ephod, which is sort of an Israelite underwear. His wife, Michal, disapproved of this. She said, David, you made a fool of yourself today. This led to a total alienation between David and his wife, Michal, who was Saul's daughter, and so David never had any children by Saul's daughter, which was also convenient for him politically, since an heir of Saul might be a threat to the throne. But that's a very complex political story in the book of 2 Samuel. Then verse 8 here is, the first seven verses really refer in very brief fashion to this search for the ark. Verses 8 through 10 you can imagine as a kind of a hymn. I believe, as do many other scholars, that this psalm was used each year when the ark was once again processed. It was taken out into the countryside and processed back into Jerusalem in a reenactment of that finding of the ark and the bringing it to Jerusalem. And this, verses 8 to 10, may well be a hymn that was sung as the ark is brought back to Jerusalem. Arise, O Lord, and go to thy resting place, thou and the ark of thy might. Let thy priests be clothed with righteousness. Let thy saints shout for joy for thy servant David's sake. Do not turn away the face of thy anointed one. Then, after this little reenactment and the bringing of the ark to Jerusalem, verses 11 and 12 reaffirm the promise to David, and verses 13 to 16, really, reaffirm God's choice of Zion as a dwelling place. So here in the great festival occasion, those central elements of the faith, of the community's faith conviction are reaffirmed. The Lord swore to David a sure oath from which he will not turn back. One of the sons of your body I will set on your throne. If, an important condition here, if your sons keep my covenant. Now, one of the things that happened with the kingship was that as the kingship went on, the kings began to regard themselves as immune from the demands of the covenant, and the prophets were forced to come forward to confront them. But here, in the I think this is a very early psalm, going back quite early in the tradition after the formation of the kingship. Here it's clear that even the king's rule, as God, who is God's anointed, even that office is conditional on the keeping of the covenant. So the holding of this memory alive becomes an important tradition over against which the prophets can hold even a king accountable. Even a king is not immune from the covenant demands. Then verse 13 talks about the choosing of Zion. For the Lord has chosen Zion, he has desired it for his habitation. This is my resting place forever. Here I will dwell, for I have desired it. You can see these words being said once again as the ark is brought anew each year into the temple, placed into its place. The Lord dwells in our midst once again. It's a dramatic reenactment of that of that central linchpin of confidence and trust that God is with us. God is dwelling in our midst, even. Now, a psalm which may also come from that great processional of the ark is Psalm 24. It does not reflect so much of the tradition of David, but reflects some very important additional elements of the tradition. This is one that's very familiar to us all, but I don't know if sometimes the Psalms are so familiar that we don't give any thought to what their setting might have been or what their meaning could possibly have been. This one, I think, is also a processional psalm used at one of the great festival occasions for the processing of the ark back into Jerusalem and into the temple. This begins with a hymn of praise. You can imagine the priests and the pilgrims out on the road outside of Jerusalem at the beginning of the processional, singing these lines of praise at the beginning of Psalm 24. The earth is the Lord's and the fullness thereof, the world and those who dwell therein, for he has founded it upon the seas and established it upon the rivers. Founding it upon creation, founded on the seas and established on the rivers, refers to that tradition of creation as the overcoming of chaos, the establishment of order which triumphs over chaos. And chaos is almost always described in terms of water, the watery chaos. And so the floods, the seas, the rivers, any of these references in the Psalms that are connected with God as creator refer to God's establishing of order over the watery chaos. Now, after this brief hymn of praise, imagine now the processional approaching the walls of the city, or perhaps the walls of the temple precinct. Unclear which. And someone and the people, someone is standing there, a priest perhaps, as the gatekeeper. And I think this is antiphonal, responsive in this part of the psalm. Imagine then the people, the pilgrims with the ark there, perhaps led by a group of priests or temple singers, who shout out, "Who shall ascend the hill of the Lord, and who shall stand in his holy place?" This could almost be understood permissively. Who may ascend the hill of the Lord? Who may stand in his holy place? And the keeper of the gate sings back or calls back, "He who has clean hands and a pure heart, who does not lift up his soul to what is false and does not swear deceitfully, he will receive blessing from the Lord and vindication from the God of his salvation." And then the people, I think verse 6 is the people again, sing forth, "Such is the generation of those who seek him. We are such. We do have clean hands and a pure heart. We do intend to live out this concept of righteousness. Such is the generation of those who seek him, who seek the face of the God of Jacob." So the people, before entry again into the temple, on this great festival occasion, are asked to reaffirm their commitment to the demands of righteousness laid on the covenant community. It is not enough simply to be a pilgrim present and an Israelite. One must reaffirm that commitment to living out a different kind of existence as the covenant community. Now, we're going to see this in even greater detail in a couple of other psalms in a moment. So this is a foreshadowing of some other psalms where we'll see that difference in lifestyle. But here, even on this great festival occasion, that's held forward. And then, having reaffirmed that, we indeed are those who have clean hands and a pure heart. We do not lift up our souls to what is false, nor swear deceitfully, so on. Then the gatekeeper, perhaps all the people, who knows, but there's a great opening hymn here, a hymn for the opening of the gate. Lift up your heads, O gates. Be lifted up, O ancient doors, that the King of Glory may come in. And again, you can hear antiphonal elements to this hymn. Who is the King of Glory? The Lord strong and mighty, the Lord mighty in battle. Lift up your heads, O gates, and be lifted up, O ancient doors, that the King of Glory may come in. Who is this King of Glory? The Lord of hosts. He is the King of Glory. Magnificent hymn for the opening of the gates and the entry of the procession into the city. Now, we looked in our very first session at some psalms that I called salvation history psalms. I want now to tell you that although it was important to look at some of those psalms then, which show an overview of the whole memory tradition of Israel, that those psalms are also festival psalms. The occasions on which the salvation history psalms were appropriate were the festival occasions, when you had great recitations of the saving events. We looked at Psalm 136 that time. We might just glance at Psalm 78. It's a long one. I don't want to go through it in any detail. But you might just glance at 78. Here's one. This psalm is simply a story, the retelling of God's great deeds and the people's encounter with that God in Israel's history. And you can see how long it is. It's 72 verses. And it goes, if you were to read through this psalm, you would find it going through all of the great events of Israel's history, reciting and recalling them, coming clear down to the choosing of David in verse 70 as the final episode of this story. This betrays its southern and Judean origins, which is not surprising. But these psalms were also appropriately used on the great festival occasions. The important point to remember here is the important role that memory played in the tradition of Israel. Without the sharpness of that memory, Israel ran the risk of losing the identity out of which she was formed. One of the things that I was in another lecture yesterday, I was talking about the growth of a kind of royal consciousness that undermined the initial identity of the community. Well, the kings that are most guilty of that royal consciousness which dims the memory of Israel are those who are described in the tradition as having let the temple fall into disrepair and the festivals go unobserved and began to allow Canaanite practices to creep in. And they are in control of the temple, but not for the purposes of keeping the memory of Israel alive and sharp. That memory of Israel is the only thing which protects it from simply being assimilated into the cultures which surround her, because Israel is very different from those surrounding cultures in certain respects, particularly in her religious life, so that the great cultural pressure which comes to bear on Israel at every moment in that history is mostly pressure for assimilation and accommodation. Without the constant renewal of that memory tradition, it's hard to see how Israel could have survived the pressures for accommodation and assimilation. And there's a word to us there in terms of the pressures for cultural accommodation to us. The keeping alive and sharp the memories of our tradition in vital worship becomes fundamental for maintaining an identity which is not merely a reflection of the identity of the surrounding culture. This is what Jürgen Moltmann says, that one of the dangers of the church is that losing a sense of her own identity, she runs the risk of becoming the chameleon church, And that's a church that simply takes on the coloration of whatever cultural or ideological setting it finds itself in. It's the memory of the community of faith that protects against that danger. I might say parenthetically that the other side of that, he says that that those who are so concerned for identity that they ignore the involvement of the church in the world run the risk on the other end of becoming the fossil church, which is an extremely faithful witness to the past but incapable of becoming anything else in the present or the future. So the life of the community of faith is lived out somewhere between those dangers of being either the fossil church or the chameleon church. And worship is vital to that. Worship is often identified only with the identity side of that. But worship, I think, is a holding forth not only of the memory of the community, but is also a reminder of the vision of the community, the future-oriented thrust which sends us out into the world. Now, I want to look briefly at some of the Psalms relating to kingship here. I'll readily admit to start with that the kingship Psalms give me some problems theologically, because not so much because the Psalms themselves are problems, but because I see kingship as having been a very ambiguous development in the life of Israel. There are many senses in which the development of kingship in Israel undermined and undercut the authentic sense of community out of which Israel was born. And the prophets become the reminders of that. But I have come to believe that the kingship themes in Israel are kept vital and important to the degree that they acknowledge that the true king, the true sovereign, is God. The earthly king is only a representative of that. Once the earthly king begins to think of his own role as an end in its own right, you get all of the dangers which the historic materials in the Old Testament tell us crept in with the kings. And eventually that leads to the disastrous experience of Babylonian exile. And there are many ways in which the Babylonian exile can be described as a failure of the kind of community that was ushered in by the kings and the organization of the nation around kingship. But to the degree that even the earthly kings acknowledge the kingship of God, then even the role of the king can be a servant role. Look at Psalm 2. An interesting psalm. Psalm 2 is probably a coronation psalm. This was probably used on the occasion of crowning a king. I'm not going to take time to look at it all. It talks about the Lord's support of his king. The important verse here is verse 7. That's the place I want to point our attention. Think of this now on the occasion of an installation of a king. I will tell of the decree of the Lord. He said to me, "You are my son. Today I have begotten you." So on. This has become a very important verse for scholars who study the institutions of ancient Israel, because it indicates the important notion that the king in Israel was never regarded as a divine being, a member of the pantheon from birth. This was the case in Egypt and Mesopotamia. This is often called an adoption formula. It's that the king's relationship to God is one established by God's adoption of the king in that moment when the king assumes that role. A relationship begins. The interesting thing about this verse, of course, is that it is then picked up and used of Jesus on the occasion of the baptism of Jesus. And I don't know if you ever thought about this before, but you know, messiahship is a royal theme in the first place. Messiah means anointed one. And that was the title for the kings of David in the Old Testament, anointed one, Messiah. So there's a sense in which the Gospels then present Jesus as the true king, whereas the earthly kings have failed in their obedience to God. And so even the baptism of Jesus is not only a baptism, it's a royal coronation. Jesus eventually rides into the city in triumphal procession on Palm Sunday on the back of a donkey, and that's the way the kings entered in the coronation festivals. He ends up with a crown of thorns instead of a crown of gold. Of course, the contrasts of Jesus' kind of kingship are as important as the similarities. But those royal themes are picked up, reused in a radically different and new way in the Gospels, and this is one of the verses here. Most of the Psalms dealing with kingship in the Psalter, however, deal with God's kingship. And Psalm 2 is something of a rarity. There are only a handful of Psalms that really talk and celebrate the kingship of the earthly king. The real celebration is the kingship of God, which the earthly king only represents. That's the proper focus if the king is to be a servant. When that focus is lost, the king begins to become a danger and a threat to God's covenant. Look at Psalm 93. This is a very brief, what we call an enthronement psalm, which deals with God's kingship. The Lord reigns. See, it's the Lord who reigns or rules. He is robed in majesty. The Lord is robed, he is girded with strength. Yea, the world is established, it shall never be moved. Thy throne is established from of old, thou art from everlasting. And then here's the theme of the floods. Almost always God's kingship is connected with creation themes. That it, God who creates also rules. The floods have lifted up, O Lord. This is the chaotic waters. The floods have lifted up their voice. The floods lift up their roaring. Mightier than the thunders of many waters, mightier than the waves of the sea, the Lord on high is mighty. Thy decrees are very sure. Holiness befits thy house, O Lord, forevermore. So in spite of the threat of chaos, the Lord still reigns. Psalm 95 is also a celebration of God's kingship. O come, let us sing to the Lord. Let us make a joyful noise to the rock of our salvation. Let us come into his presence with thanksgiving. Let us make a joyful noise from the songs of praise. For the Lord is a great God and a great King above all gods. In his hand are the depths of the earth. The heights of the mountains are his also. The sea is his, for he made it. For his hands formed the dry land. Notice we're back in creation language again. O come, let us worship and bow down. Let us kneel before the Lord our Maker. There's a combination of kingly and creation themes. The Lord our Maker, but it is to the Lord our Maker that we give obeisance as to a king. For he is our God, and we are the people of his pasture and the sheep of his hand. So then there's a brief section of this psalm that refers to the... It's kind of a warning against disobedience. It speaks of the rebellion of people. We could go on. There's a whole section here of hymns to the kingship of God. Psalms 96, 97, 98, 99 are all hymns celebrating the kingship of God. And you can see that 97 and 98 both begin with the phrase, "The Lord reigns," which is one of the great liturgical shouts of the celebration of God's lordship or God's rulership over all the earth. One of the most interesting psalms dealing with God's kingship, though, is a psalm that could be described as almost satirical in nature, and it's found in Psalm 82.
Out of all the Psalms which celebrate God's kingship, this is one I wanted to use as a transition, because it shows that when the Lord reigns, when the community comes together and acknowledges that it is the Lord who rules, then the demands, the differences, I'm not saying this right, when we acknowledge that the Lord reigns, then we cannot live as if we were solely in control of our own lives. Even the king cannot live that way when we acknowledge that it is the Lord who truly reigns. And part of that is because this God, from the beginning, as a part of the memory of Israel, has revealed himself to be a different kind of God than the other gods that were known. Now you may, I don't know how much we've talked about this week. I get, sometimes I remember things we talked about last week in the Bible study and assuming. But this God is one who revealed himself from the beginning as a God caring for and concerned for the dispossessed, and not manifesting himself only where earthly power was already present. The gods of the great empires were said to be powerful when their empires were powerful. This God showed his greatest moment of power when his people were slaves in Egypt. Extending that on into the New Testament, our God showed his greatest power in death, which became new life. Not in some earthly triumph or some metaphor of earthly power. Now this means that when such a God reigns, when a God like that reigns, the kind of community that remembers and celebrates and serves such a God is going to be a different kind of community. Psalm 82 reveals the different character of this God compared to the other gods of the ancient Near East. And it's, think of it as satirical. Look at the setting in verse 1 to start with. God has taken his place in the divine council. In the midst of the gods, he holds judgment. And remember, this is a tradition already. Hebrew tradition is well on its way to a solid monotheism by this point. But here is a picture of God taking his seat in the council of the gods. You all are the council of the gods here. Not his seat, he has taken his place. Actually, that could be translated, God has taken his stand in the divine council. I think it really means that he rose to speak in the council of the gods. And then, verse 2 is the start of God's speech. How long will you judge unjustly and show partiality to the wicked? Give justice to the weak and the fatherless. Maintain the right of the afflicted and the destitute. Rescue the weak and the needy. Deliver them from the hand of the wicked. Then, this next verse, I think, is almost like an aside to the audience. You can almost think of this as a great drama in the liturgy. You can sort of imagine God, after he's given this stirring address to the council of God, saying, they have neither knowledge nor understanding. They walk about in darkness. All the foundations of the earth are shaken. They don't know anything. Then he says, I say, you are God's sons of the Most High, all of you. Nevertheless, you shall die like men and fall like any prince. He just demoted them from being gods. They're going to die like anyone else. They're going to pass away. They are nothing. Why are they nothing? Because they have not cared for the truly important things, which this psalm says have to do with justice and the upholding of the oppressed and the afflicted. That's the mark of a true God. And then this psalm ends, I think, with an affirmation of the congregation who has witnessed this reenactment, who say, arise, O God, judge the earth, for to thee belong all the nations. God's justice
is the criteria by which we say there is only one God. These other gods that other nations claim are not truly gods because they don't act in godlike ways. And for Israel, God's nature, the divine nature, is established as one concern for the upholding of justice. So this is quite a strong statement against the gods of the other nations, but you can imagine this as kind of a humorous little note in one of the festival occasions too. Well, if the God Israel celebrates in her worship is such a God, then the community which serves that God is going to be rather different. So you find psalms like Psalm 15. This psalm could be described in two ways. It's sometimes called a prophetic psalm. That means that it takes up themes that are reminiscent of the prophets. But it's also an entrance liturgy like Psalm 24. You remember where the psalm said, "Who shall ascend the hill of the Lord?" Well, this is also an entrance liturgy, but one which spells out even more fully the covenant demands laid on the community. This community must live differently if it is to come before God. O Lord, who shall sojourn in thy tent? Who shall dwell on thy holy hill? And then listen to this catalog of things. He who walks blamelessly and does what is right and speaks truth from his heart, who does not slander with his tongue and does no evil to his friend, nor takes up a reproach against his neighbor, and whose eyes, and I don't like this translation, reprobate does not mean what this Hebrew word means to me. The word being translated here is one which means someone who does not do honor to God, and almost like an apostate rather than a reprobate. In whose eyes an apostate is despised, but who honors those who fear the Lord, who swears to his own hurt and does not change. This one would get most of us. Who does not put out his money at interest and does not take a bribe against the innocent. He who does these things shall never be moved. So right here in the worship and liturgical life of Israel, an ideal for a different way, a concept of a different way of living out the life of the community is being held forward. Those who would approach God are those who take seriously the demands of covenant obedience. Because if we look back at the covenantal passages, and the prophetic passages reaffirming that covenant, we would find these very same qualities being held forward as the essence of covenant obedience. There are some psalms here that perhaps are not as rooted in the liturgical life, or at least they're used in more of a teaching sense, like Psalm 49. Psalm 49 happened to be the psalm for this past Sunday's reading at the Eucharist. It's a psalm that we describe in terms of type as a wisdom psalm. There's a whole group of psalms that seem less liturgical than pedagogical. And it may be that they were used more in teaching settings than in liturgy settings. The temple, one of the things we'll have to remember, and this is a bit analogous to the church as an institution in our own experience, the temple was also a center of teaching and learning. So the temple's sole function was not simply the offering of sacrifices and the formal occasions of liturgical life, but they were also concerned to instruct the community in the upholding of the covenant and the knowledge of the Torah, although that's a term that comes in a little later. The wisdom psalms seem to have more of a teaching view in mind. But here's a wisdom psalm that picks up that theme of what is demanded of the community that serves the God we've seen revealed in these liturgical materials. Hear this, all peoples, give ear, all inhabitants of the world, both low and high, rich and poor together. My mouth shall speak wisdom. That's one of the key words of the whole wisdom tradition, and the other is understanding in this next verse. The meditation of my heart shall be understanding. I will incline my ear to a proverb. I will solve my riddle to the music of the lyre. That's all introduction. Here comes the problem on which the teaching is focused. Why should I fear in times of trouble when the iniquity of my persecutors surrounds me? Men who trust in their wealth and boast of the abundance of their riches. Truly no man can ransom himself or give to God the price of his life. For the ransom of his life is costly and can never suffice that he should continue to live on forever and never see the pit, that's the grave. Yea, he shall see that even the wise die. The fool and the stupid alike must perish and leave their wealth to others. Their graves are their homes forever, their dwelling places to all generations, though they named lands their own. So even if the land carries their name, they won't survive because of their wealth any more than the poor man. Man cannot abide in his pomp. He is like the beasts that perish. This is the fate of those who have foolish confidence, the end of those who are pleased with their portion. Death is their lot as well. Now, the wisdom psalms often take up this theme of the wise and the foolish, the rich and the poor, great dichotomies spelled out in the wisdom psalms, prosperity and anything that is a part of our human existence is not sufficient foundation for trust. Only God is the sufficient foundation for trust. And it's in God that we are truly blessed. Eventually, in the late periods, reflected in some of these wisdom psalms, the law, or the Torah, as an embodiment of covenant, comes to the foreground. Psalm 1, which is kind of an introduction to the whole book of Psalms, is a wisdom psalm, which deals with the fate of the righteous and the wicked. And it says, "Blessed is the man who walks not in the counsel of the wicked, nor stands in the way of sinners, nor sits in the seat of scoffers. But his delight is in the law of the Lord, and on his law he meditates day and night." Now, law, still in this period, is very closely wedded to covenant. Law is only legitimate as it expresses the demands of covenant obedience. Now, in the post-Old Testament period, and already beginning to assert itself in the very latest periods of the Old Testament community, is a concept of law which operates independently from covenant and becomes fixed. It's that concept of the law which is described in the New Testament as bondage to the law. And it's, I think when Jesus said, "I came not to abolish the law, but to fulfill it," he's referring to that concept of the law as expressive of covenant obedience, which goes clear back into the Old Testament tradition. But here, the law is an expression of covenant, and it says those who are focused on the law of the Lord and meditate on that day and night are like trees planted by streams of water, and so on, yield fruit. And then the rest of the psalm is a contrast with the wicked, who are like chaff which the wind drives away. Therefore the wicked will not stand in the judgment. Another psalm which shows some of this dimension of covenant obedience demanded of the people, the different way of living out the faith that comes from the focus on the kind of God celebrated in the Psalms, is Psalm 14. this shows that even the Hebrews had to struggle with cynicism in their own age. And this is the psalm which begins with that famous line, "The fool says in his heart, there is no God. They are corrupt, they do abominable deeds. There is none that does good. God looks down from the heaven upon the children of men to see if there are any that act wisely, that seek after God. They have all gone astray. They are all alike corrupt. There is none that does good, no, not one." This is a rather cynical psalm itself. "Have they no knowledge, all the evildoers who eat up my people as they eat bread?" You see, their evil doing is expressed in terms of their use of people, their manipulation and exploitation of people. "Who eat up my people as they eat bread." Isn't that an image? "And do not call upon the Lord." Then there's a judgment pronounced against them. "There they shall be in great terror, for God is with the generation of the righteous. You who would confound the plans of the poor," you would confound the plans of the poor, those to whom this psalm is addressed, "but the Lord is his refuge." So here again is that God who is particularly on the side of those who are the marginal, the defenseless, those who are the exploited. "Oh, that deliverance for Israel would come out of Zion when the Lord restores the fortunes of his people," so on. Well, we could go on pointing out examples of these. I wanted to say a word about one additional category of psalm here at the end, because it is such a well-known and beloved category. There's one category of psalms that really do not have as their setting the corporate worship of Israel in the temple, and that's because and they're sometimes called psalms of trust, and they're sometimes called pilgrimage psalms. And they are psalms that probably had as their setting the journey of the pilgrim to Jerusalem, to the temple. And for that journey, these psalms are resources of confidence and trust as one moves to the holy place. The most famous of these psalms are the 23rd Psalm and the 121st Psalm. The 23rd Psalm, which we all know, "The Lord is my shepherd." In the end, that psalm, I don't know if you ever recognized this before, but when it says that "I shall dwell in the house of the Lord forever," house of the Lord usually refers to the temple in the Old Testament. And this originally was a psalm which talks about of the confidence and trust of the pilgrim as he moves toward the temple. "Even though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death," whatever dangers there are. And of course, it's easy to understand how this pilgrimage psalm and this psalm of trust for the pilgrim became a psalm which speaks to us of the pilgrimage through life itself. For those who received this psalm in a tradition that no longer has a temple, this speaks of the confidence and trust which we rest in the Lord as we move through our own journeys of faith to the table of the Lord. The 121st Psalm has a similar background. It's also a very famous one that's familiar and beloved by most of us. "I lift up my eyes to the hills. From whence does my help come?" Looking up to the hills is what the pilgrim would always have done, because Jerusalem was in the highest part of the country. A pilgrimage to Jerusalem from almost any place would have you looking up to the hills. "From whence does my help come? My help comes from the Lord who made heaven and earth." Notice that this superscription on this psalm is called a song of ascent, or a psalm of going up.
"Don't worry, I will.
He will not let your foot be moved. He who keeps you will not slumber. Behold, he who keeps Israel will neither slumber nor sleep.
The Lord is your keeper. The Lord is your shade on your right hand. The sun shall not smite you by day, nor the moon by night. The Lord will keep you all from all evil. He will keep your life. The Lord will keep your going out and your coming in from this time forth and forevermore. A magnificent psalm of trust. There's a whole collection of these psalms of trust for the pilgrim that are around Psalm 121 here, beginning with the 120th and extending on over through the 134th psalm. This is a whole collection of psalms for going up to Jerusalem. I want to point our attention to one more, which is a favorite of mine, and I think it's an important one because of the contemporary situation over there. The 122nd Psalm is a psalm for Jerusalem, and I think particularly the sixth verse through the end are important as a prayer for that holy city in our own present time. Pray for the peace of Jerusalem. May they prosper who love you. Peace be within your walls and security within your towers. For my brethren and companions' sake, I will say, peace be within you. Remember that the word peace here is the word shalom. For the sake of the house of the Lord our God, I will seek your good. We can only pray that that prayer will find fruition for all of those who love Jerusalem. Well, we've only sampled the Psalter. Its riches are so vast, I hope that this might provide some stimulus for you to continue your own reading of the Psalms, perhaps with new eyes, thinking of the Psalms not so much as the things that pop up in the liturgy every now and then, and that we almost regard as merely acts of devotion. The Psalms are indeed offerings of devotion, but they are also witnesses to the vitality of a whole community of faith of which we are the heirs. And I hope in your reading of the Psalms now you can sense some of that vitality, realize that in the Psalms we have the intersection between a vital memory, which is still to be our memory, and a concern for living out the implications of that memory, which is still our concern. So I'll simply close by wishing you the blessing of the last line of the 121st Psalm. The Lord will keep your going out and your coming in from this time forth and forevermore.